he just let everything go. He didn't give a crap about anything. He just, yeah. I mean, you saw the things he said.
He was dropping F-bombs. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, oh. Yeah.
And I'm like,
welcome to Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast, your place for resources and in-depth conversations with other game development professionals. I'm your host, John J.P. Podlasic. I've worked at 10 different game companies, starting back in 1989 with the TurboGrafx-16. Over the decades, I've developed games like Mortal Kombat, Avengers Initiative, Beavis and Butthead, and numerous others. I now work for a startup called Level X. But this podcast isn't about me. It's about you and the game development community. So if you have questions or ideas, give a call, 224-484-7733, or go to the gamedevadvice.com website. So let's kick things off with the new Game Dev Advice.
Tonight's guest is Joshua Sway. He spent over two decades working in video game development as a director on key franchises, such as Mortal Kombat, Fight Night, and Tony Hawk. Having studied film in college, he accidentally got into game development and put his filming career on hold. His new documentary, Insert Coin, brings him back to his roots with a subject he holds dear. It was released on November 25th and is available for streaming and viewing at selected theaters. Hey, Josh, how are you doing tonight?
Good, John. Thanks for having me. It's nice to chat again, as always.
Yeah. So where's this call find you tonight, and how are you doing with COVID-19?
It finds me well. You know, I'm down here in my basement office, you know, like a little, like a little bunker. And, yes. I think COVID, given the craziness in the world and, you know, the COVID stuff and everything, I mean, you know, I can't really complain. I can work from home. I'd been working on this film in my basement anyway, so not a whole lot has changed. And, everyone is healthy. So I can't complain. I just hope that people who are out there that are, you know, that have fallen ill are, you know, recovering well and such. And
no, it's great to hear. And yeah, I'm exactly the same way. I've got a bunker basement office down here, and I am very lucky, like yourself, that nobody close to me is sick and I'm not sick, and we're able to work remote. All right. Before getting into Insert Coin, can you talk a little bit about your other role right now and what you got going on with that?
So, you know, right now I'm taking a break from the traditional video game industry. You know, I've been in it for a long time, and I took some time off initially to basically finish this film. But at the same time, I'm working with a company called Edge Experiential, and I've been doing a lot of experiential design. It's been really interesting. It's been kind of, it encompasses just a lot of things that I'd always been interested in or have been doing, you know, for a long time. I mean, part of it's game design or interactive entertainment, part of it's filmmaking. So, you know, I have a large project over at the SoFi Stadium in Los Angeles that we're designing out.
Oh, wow. That's
tour.
The new one, right?
Yeah, it's the new one. So, and we designed out this entire tour for the stadium. And then I have another project out in New York that I can't talk about. But it's this chance to help design a incredibly immersive theater and the film and producing the film content for it at the same time. So yeah, so it's been neat to kind of expand my range after so many years in video game design. Even though I miss video game development, it's been nice to just kind of see what else is out there.
So I watched Insert Coin the other night, and I really enjoyed it. It was, I actually learned a few things too, which, you know, was there from 2000 to 2008, but I knew a lot of the people in it, obviously, but there was stuff that I learned. So the story and the people and I think it's fantastic. When did you first have the idea to make this film? Like what was the seed of like, I need to make this?
Yeah, I think parts of it had been in my mind for quite some time, like probably, you know, probably ever since I left Midway, which was at the tail end of 99. I think what really kind of solidified for me is around, I want to say it was 2013, Polygon had asked to do a profile of myself and my career in game development. And it was a very flattering article that they did about me.
I saw that article. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And so talked to the writer of it, you know, when he was interviewing me, you know, I was talking about just, you know, my career trajectory, but particularly with Midway and how the games were and how they were created, who created them and how one game led to another. And as I was talking about it, I thought to myself, like, you know, these are stories that are for myself. They're kind of secondhand. It was like secondhand nature for me to just be able to talk so easily about them. But as I was talking about them, he was like, well, I didn't know this was related to that and how everything's connected. And so later on, it kind of dawned on me. It's like, you know what? A lot of people know about these games and a lot of people have probably seen, let's say, just individual YouTube videos about NARC or Mortal Kombat or NBA Jam, but never tied it together. And so I felt like, you know what, that's like, you know, I have enough knowledge that I can probably create a pretty compelling narrative of how this era was formed and how these games came together. Because, you know, because nothing great is created in a vacuum. We know it, you know, things always evolve from something else. And so that kind of stuck with me. So I thought, you know, this would be a good story to tell. And I really wasn't quite sure about it, but I thought, you know what, I'll make the effort to at least film enough interviews with people that I used to work with to get a trailer together and really maybe I'll put it up on Kickstarter just to see if there's enough interest. Like I wasn't really thinking about it as a Kickstarter project, but I thought, well, somebody had told me it's a really good way to see if the idea is good. Because if you put it out there.
Validation, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And it's crickets or other people like throwing money at you. It's
absolutely. Like, so like, you know, this way I'm not spending, you know, tons of time on a project that potentially I'm the only one who's interested in. So, that's basically how it all got started.
So how did the Kickstarter process go for you?
It went really well. You know, first I was able to talk to a few people who have had pretty successful Kickstarters and they gave me some great advice on what to do, you know, ahead of them, how to pre-plan everything.
Yeah,
and so, it's key. People don't realize just how much work it is. Like all the ones that are successful, you know, that they just, you know, months and months getting ready for it. And so, you know, I put it up there, you know, I was able, you know, because of my relationship with many people in particular in the games media from my years in game development, you know, I was able to generate a lot of PR for it and it went really well. And it was really funny because I was told that, hey, when you do a large Kickstarter project, you know, you'll have this big surge in the beginning and then the middle slows down a lot. It just grinds to a halt. But then at the end, it'll surge up again, you know, and that's usually, you know, just the way it works. Mm-hmm. And so luckily I knew that ahead of time. And so so that's exactly what happened. And during the middle part, when it really slowed down, I just went on vacation with my family and just ignored the Kickstarter and then came back for like the last few days of it to see it surge back up again. And just because I didn't want to get stressed out about it, you know, just like keeping my eyeballs on it constantly. You know, it went really well, went above my goal, which I set at a fairly high number because a lot back then, this is the early days of Kickstarter. Back then, people would put like ludicrously low numbers in there just so they can get the goal. And then I think the traditional
$100, I'll make this film.
Yeah, exactly. Back then, like the traditional wisdom was have it be super low because once it hits its goal, then it's going to skyrocket. And I thought that was kind of bullshit. I was like, I don't know about that. You know, that's too risky because the thing is, if I set it too low and it hits it, but it only stays that low. Now I'm suddenly committed to doing it. Right. And I have to do it at a really low budget. And so I just thought, you know what, I figured out a number that I thought was, okay, this is what I'd be comfortable with. And that's it. So if it doesn't hit that, then like, I can just move on. And so luckily it went beyond that. And then after that, we're, you know, off to the races.
And what year was this?
It was in 2015, like late 2015.
So tell us about how you did the research and the archive digging. Like there's a lot of stuff there and, you know, you're probably digging up Super 8 tapes and all that kind of stuff that I have sitting in boxes. Yeah.
I had a lot of materials myself just from my own personal collection, but it wasn't enough for a documentary, but I thought it's enough to at least get started with. And this is, you know, an example of sometimes like, you know, like the whole ignorance is bliss type thing where like, I didn't know what I didn't know, you know?
Yeah.
And so I went in thinking I'll do all these interviews and then I'll try to see if I can find the materials. I was so focused on the people, you know, I'm going to be interviewing people that I used to work with. And so I was really excited about that. And they were excited about it. So I kind of did that first. And just a side note, what I ended up learning is that that's totally backwards from the way you should do some of these documentaries. Like, there's no one way to do documentaries, but advice that I got that I found, or somebody told me much later in the process was find all of your archival materials first, and then create your story around it, you know,
that's your base, not the
exactly, right? Exactly. And it totally made sense. You know, like, I don't know if you've ever seen that show, House Hunters, like on HGTV, you know, like, you know, it's basically a couple goes out and they research three different houses and then they choose which one is right for them. It's a big show on HGTV. And it turns out that I found out that the secret to that show was that they've already bought the house. So they know which one they're getting. And then they're just shooting backwards from there. So it's the same analogy. What ended up happening was that it was just a combination of just good luck and timing, was that I got half of the interviews. And then from there, I started stringing what I thought was a story together just based on what I had. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I was looking, at various archives of, of old videos and, and like a lot of the people that I interviewed, they had Hi8 tapes or VHS sitting around. So I would just collect all of these. So one of the things that happened that I was very lucky about was Ken Fedesna, who was the vice president of Midway Kenny's awesome, right? He turns out that he went to Midway when Midway was going bankrupt and was throwing all their stuff out. He went in and saved almost all of the Midway video archives. There was tons and tons of Betacam three quarter tapes, VHS and stuff like that. They were all in the creative media department. They were about to throw them out. And he got the heads up, hey, you know what? They're throwing the stuff out. Come in and, save what you can. So he went in, saved all these tapes, and he had it at his office at his new company, TeamPlay. Yeah. And so for the longest time, I was trying to get Kenny to be interviewed for the documentary. He just didn't want to do it. He just, for various reasons. Yeah. And I understand it's tough to get interviewed about things. And so what ended up happening was that I found out that he had these tapes. And so I just told him, Kenny, if you don't want to be in the video, I totally respect that. But can you give me access to your tapes? And he's like, yeah, of course. What's mine is yours. Go, as long as I get them back, go take whatever you need. And so I had that access to this. And that was a gold mine. And that literally saved the documentary. And again, had I been more experienced, I would have done that first and then did the interviews, then commit myself to the documentary, but I had already been committed. So luckily it saved my ass. And so a lot of the footage come from Kenny's archives. Now, one of the cool things is that because I was always hanging out at Ken's office, looking through these tapes, I was able to wear him down. And after 6 months, of asking, I finally went into his office and I was completely prepared. And this one is hey, Kenny, I'm here. Why don't we just have a quick chat on video? And if you don't like what's going on, then I won't use it, And then finally he's just all right, let's do it. He was in a good mood that day. And so, and that was very late in the process of the film. And he as you've seen in the film, he's kind of the glue of the film.
He is. I was going to say he gives context for everything. And he was there since 71 or something
I mean, all the way back in the early heydays with pinball. And here's something crazy is that in his office, and he just recently donated all this to the Strong Museum of Play out in Rochester, New York. He had a shelf with gigantic binders in them. And they're all the binders were seriously about 6 inches thick of just paper. And then he had a whole shelf of these. And I asked him what those were. And he said, those are all my notes I've taken over the years. I'm like, holy shit, And so he basically said, ask me a question about any of the games, any date, that you can think of. And I probably have something for it. So, I think I threw something out how much did WrestleMania make in, November 1994? how many quarters did it, did it generate that month? And he goes through his things and he found it right there. He had all the information, which arcades made how much money and all these things. It was insane.
That is wild. And I have nothing but respect for Kenny. I always enjoyed working with him. And he is kind of a low key. He's not the center of attention, and he's just this smart, steady, good person.
Ken was really a great example of this, is that because of the stuff that we're talking about is 20 plus years old now. Everybody was super candid. So once Ken started talking, he just opened up about so many things. That was one of the things I was really grateful about, was the candidness of everybody talking about, about working at Midway. I was kind of surprised by how candid some people were, to be quite honest with you. But it was great because it's been a long passage of time.
Time passes and then people are more open to talking about things, and it's I can talk about this. The world's not going to end. You know, so, I remember, man, there was one time we were working on MK Deadly Alliance or Deception. I can't remember which one it was, but we walked into his office and there was just like a bug, you know, after an all-nighter, and there was like a slowdown bug with like the PAL version. And we're just like, oh, we sent the discs and they were wrong. And he's like, well, maybe, you know, but he was very cool about it, right?
Yeah.
You know, there wasn't table flipping and or any of that kind of stuff. And we figured it out, but I just remember like, all right, we got to tell Kenny. And I was like, I'll go down there with you. So we walked down there and talked with him, and he was cool and level-headed, and we took care of the situation. He didn't freak out, and he wasn't. Yep. So what about, you know, some other kind of challenges you had to overcome? I mean, there's
finding the materials. I got very lucky on them. There were times where I literally had tapes that had no labels on them that I would ignore. And then I would look at them and realize this was exactly what I needed for a certain segment. I mean, there are so many times where that happened that it's like
gold right here in front of me, but it wasn't labeled.
Yeah. They're like little miracles. So that, you know, obviously that, you know, that was a big deal. I think, you know, the other thing is just, you know, certain people were hard to get, you know? So like I said, like Kenny was, you know, Ken, you know, I got to wear him down and stuff. And like, you know, Mark Tremell, you know, it's, I had interviewed him earlier for the trailer, but then getting him to come back, and he's a busy guy, but getting him to come back for the actual film itself took a while to do. And again, I don't blame him, because I put some of these people through the grinder. I mean, we were having like multiple 2 to 3 hour sessions of interviews. Right. And so, and you know, a lot of people don't realize when it comes to documentaries, you know, you have at minimum 100-to-1 ratio of shot footage to what you ended up with. So, you know, basically trying to, you know, time everything and track people down was definitely a challenge. I think the biggest thing though that hit me hard was trying to fit everything into a feature film and having it flow quickly and getting the information out there in an interesting way without turning the film into an encyclopedia. You know what I mean? I mean, ultimately has to be entertaining and has to have a good steady pace to it. And, you know, so there's that saying, like, you got to learn to kill your babies. And I had, you know, there's just a lot of stuff that ended up not being in the film that I had to cut out. And it was excruciatingly painful. And, you know, I understand.
You're like, this is 4 hours. I can't have
Seriously. I
editing had room floor. Here we go.
Yeah. I had I had a 4 hour movie. I tried to make it be episodic because that was like, it's very trendy to make episodic documentaries. But the thing is that you know, the audience for something like that, it's there, but it's very small. It's not something that I wanted to do my first time around. You know, I didn't want to like come out with something that was like really bloated, was not going to be more universally liked by people. And so, so trying to understand what should stay and what shouldn't stay and the reasoning behind it was a real struggle for me. And, you know,
you making the decision, right? I mean,
and that's the thing. Yeah. And I think that was ultimately like, I did not want to make the entire film pretty much by myself. You know, that was never the goal. It was like, I wanted to shoot it myself because there's a certain intimacy I have with the subjects that I knew I can get really good interviews out of. So that part I knew I was going to do. And I knew I was going to probably do the rough cut of the film. But from there, you know, you want to always have an editor go into your film. And like, you need to kind of walk away and let an editor take care of it because it's an extra set of eyes. They're going to be more objective about
perspective.
It.
Perspective. Yeah.
Exactly. And that was always the original plan. But the more I started doing the film, there were certain ideas in my head that I wanted in the film that I was struggling to get in. And my fear was that if I have an editor come in, I wouldn't be able to communicate what I was looking for and it would be lost forever. So I got really paranoid about that. And so that's why I ended up editing myself, and not to toot my own horn, but I feel like I was able to pull it off because I took a lot of time to do it. You know, I think a professional editor probably could have gotten this film done a lot faster, but I think a lot of subtle nuances would have gotten thrown out because of, not through that person's fault, but more about, you know, me going through the process of getting my thoughts, you know, out onto the screen properly.
Yeah.
So that was interesting. You know, like I had, you know, an example was that I had a whole segment about the WrestleMania game and how the wrestlers came in to Midway Chicago for all the shoots and everything. And it was the first game I ever worked on. So it's very near and dear to my heart. And that segment was in the film. it was right next to the segment about Revolution X. And so we had WrestleMania. One, yeah. And then the Aerosmith one. It dawned on me that those two segments were basically telling the same story, which is
right. You know, so you gotta pick one, right?
Yeah. Like, you know, hey, you know, superstars are now coming to Midway to be in our games because Mortal Kombat and NBA Jam were so successful. Mm-hmm. And, but that didn't necessarily mean that you're going to come out with a good game. And so the both stories kind of had that thing going on. And,
right.
You know, looking at it, I realized, oh, I'm just, you know, like they're both interesting, but you can't have two things back to back, you know? So,
right.
So it's things like that I had to kind of learn, like I had to learn how to compress story concepts into a single segment as opposed to try to throw everything, you know, everything but the kitchen sink in.
Yeah. And then you're just like, all right, you just kind of eyeballing like, one of you have to go. And
yeah.
Exactly. Sorry, WrestleMania.
Yeah.
Maybe in the extended director's cut version, but yeah. not in this version.
Yep. Thank God for Blu-rays, man.
Yeah. it does feel weird when you hand off the editing to somebody else. Personally, with this podcast, like I had a great person that was editing it and following direction and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, I was like, this is content, right? This is the end result. So maybe it's my OCD-ness and stuff like that. But then I just switch back to like, I will just go through GarageBand and just tick, tick, tick everything the way I exactly want it. And it takes longer, but the end result is like exactly what I had in my mind when I recorded it. Yeah. So kind of like what you did is like, yeah. Right. What about surprises like that went better than you thought it would? Like, wow.
Oh, wow.
Wow, that was great.
I'm not sure. Everything seemed really hard. So I think, you know what it was? I think what came out, what I would say came out easier than I thought was interviewing everybody, you know, because I wasn't quite sure. Yeah. In my mind, I'm thinking, okay, I don't think any of these guys hate me, so it should be pretty easy to interview them. And luckily, that was the case. But
no, Neil, there might have been a lot of animosity.
And naturally, I'm glad you brought him up because that was actually, you know, I thought to myself, out of all the interviews, that's going to be toughest is going to be Neil, you know?
Right.
And because I thought to myself, well, you know, I mean, you know, he's a high level executive, he's a CEO of the company and stuff. You know, he doesn't need to talk to me if he didn't want to. And I was super lucky to get to interview him because he's never done interviews before, and so was able to get him, and he was just going to be very apprehensive about things, and he just let everything go. He didn't give a crap about anything. You saw the things he said.
He was dropping F-bombs. I'm like, well, that is Neil, right? And you would walk around with a lit cigar saying like, did he just say that?
Hey, hope you're enjoying the show. If you are, please go to patreon.com/gamedevadvice. We'd love to see if you can support the show and help new episodes keep coming out. That's patreon.com/gamedevadvice. Thanks.
Yeah. And so it was the Neil that I remember and stuff. And, but it was like, and it was amazing. He just, he's very candid about things. He has a very specific viewpoint of the world. He's, you know, he's very much a businessman and it's interesting. And so he was super easy and really everybody was super easy. I didn't have any issues with, you know, people having second thoughts about what they thought, what they said or anything like that. And so that went really well. Now, the flip side of it was that everybody talks so much that now I'm going to go back to my editing problem was that there was like too much material. I mean, there was so much and just trying to sift through that and trying to figure out how to edit it down to, you know, 100 minutes and have it flow and everything. You know, that was, it was a good problem to have basically.
What about a funny or odd story? I'm sure you got tons of them.
There was quite a few. I mean, one of the more interesting things was just learning about the business side of things. Like I understood the arcade business, but hearing it directly from Ken and Neil was really interesting. I think one of the funniest stories, you know, in a different way was interviewing Ernest Cline out in Austin, Texas. And Ernest is the author of Ready Player One.
And
it's very lucky that I was able to get him. And he basically said, yeah, come on down to Austin, you know, I'll give you 2 hours and, shoot the interview.
Yeah.
So we rented out space at an arcade and they were closed. And so it was nice and quiet for us. And I'm there and I look out my window and this, like, you know, DeLorean from Back to the Future drives in. And it's Ernest Cline.
Yeah.
And he's like, what the hell? And so he comes out and he's a super nice guy. We do an interview. We end up interviewing for like almost 4 hours because the guy is an encyclopedia of pop culture. I mean, it was amazing. And so we talked about all kinds of things and stuff. And towards the end of the interview, I see him kind of looking out the window out of his car. So I wonder what's going on. And I look out and there's a crowd of kids around his DeLorean, and I'm like, holy
smokes. Back to the future.
Exactly. So we wrapped up the interview and he went out, just a super nice guy. He's, oh, hey, let me open up the car for you guys, can sit in and stuff. Yeah. Right. So he opens up the car, turns on the Back to the Future soundtrack on the stereo, opens up the back, brings out the hoverboard, puts it on display for them. He has a Ghostbusters backpack thing and everything. He's had everything ready and just let the kids, and their parents and everything to take pictures and hang out with them and everything like that.
That's cool.
Yeah, it was just the coolest thing. The guy is just loving the moment. He's so into pop culture, but he just loves sharing it with people. And so that was a ton of fun.
If I remember right from the movie, he was very spun up about the Pleasure Dome and Smash TV, right?
Exactly.
Wow, he is pissed. I remember that, and it was Kamel likes to do those kind of things. We got this thing. Whatever, but I was like, damn, he is pissed.
It was funny that because I, in all honesty, I didn't even know about that, and when. So Termel, I hadn't interviewed Termel yet about it. And so Ernest Cline was talking about it, and I wasn't quite sure. I didn't quite know what he was talking about. And then later on, I brought it up with Termel, I didn't even bring it up. Termel brought it up himself. And then I had to tell him later, Ernest Cline talked about this thing. I didn't realize it was such a big deal. it's like Ernie, I mean, he really, obviously, it's obvious from his book and from the movie Ready Player One, but he just really knows video games to a deep level. Which is really cool.
Yeah, he's very passionate about it. Yeah, and I had no idea that there was that other version done that added that extra part at the end with the Pleasure Dome to make it.
That they slapped together in a day, I think,
Right, and it's and it's also manual, right? It's not, connect to the internet and you update, so you had to do the EEPROM, what percentage actually had it versus didn't, I remember doing it. We did a play test for the grid. We were going up to the 11th hour and updating it, and then taking the EEPROMs out and doing the play test and all that kind of stuff. So
I remember those days. Yeah, just going to the test arcades. Yeah. Just trying to get those chips in. That's hilarious.
Yeah, and all right, reboot now. All right, let's see, make sure the chips work. And so what's next? Any sequels or director's cut?
Oh man. Right now we're in distribution and sales mode for some time now. It's funny because I'm starting to have flashbacks to the game testing days because the film is going through QC and I was just like, wait, they have QC for films? That's weird. And so things would come back. It's like, oh, we've seen these mistakes and these. And I was like, what are you talking about? And I didn't, but then I go in and I was like, oh geez, how have I missed that? There's a lot of little
binders
small...
on, right? You've been looking at it for so long.
Exactly. So I've been going through that, but it's cracking me up because it's nothing compared to game test, and it's funny because I've had people ask me, it's like, well, hey, what's easier, making a film or making a game? It's like, oh, making a game is actually so much harder than making a film. Not that making a film is easy, but I always tell people there's nothing harder than making a video game in any, when it comes to any entertainment media. It's like you can hide a lot of stuff in films, or if you're doing animation or whatever, you're writing a book.
You can't solve, dissolve.
And it's just like, I always have to explain to people, it's like, and it's nothing against what they're working on, but it's just, try building a world that you have to think of every possible angle, every possible possibility of that world. And you have to take all that stuff into account, no matter what you do, you're going to fail at it because somebody's going to find something wrong. There's going to be a bug and you just can't, it's never going to be perfect, but you're trying to do that. But making the film itself has been super enjoyable, in comparison.
Games are just so crazy. And it's like, you think you're there and you've got everything figured out for the most part. And then when you get into QA and especially if you're not testing along the way and you just put some people on it and they just trash it and they find all this stuff. And then it's like, you got to fix all this. And then it's like, don't slay the messenger. Like, QA is just doing their job.
Yeah.
But it's
exactly.
Oh, wow. How did you find this?
At one point, somebody, like, I was getting tired of just the back and forth. And at one point, something came back about the audio. And it's like, I've never heard, about this error before. So I asked my sound person, like, what is this term? And he said that he's never seen that. So he said, just tell the QC people that it's as designed. And I was like, wait, I can do that? Like, I remember that from games. Exactly. I didn't know I could do that. So I went back. I told him, like, no, this is as designed. I'm like, oh, okay. It's like, had I known that earlier, I would have, like, racked my brain trying to figure this out.
Sweat bullets over there. But yeah, that was always when you get a game, it's just like, it says design. Just go away. Just go find the other things. Quit picking stuff that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Find the big stuff.
So we've been doing just the distribution, and it's been interesting times. Obviously with COVID and everything, the film has gone through the film festival circuit, but they're not physical festivals; they're all online and such. So which is great.
South by Southwest, right? You were premiering there pre-COVID, right?
Exactly. And then that hit, and when that happened with South by, I had so many people contact me, say, "Oh my God, you must be feeling like hell, or you must be gutted by this." It was weird because I was so happy to just get into South by. That was not planned, and so it's kind of like I was happy, it's kind of like when a movie is just happy to be nominated for an Oscar. Like, for me, happy that I got in South by. And so when that got canceled, I was obviously disappointed, but a weird part of me was like, okay, you know what? I'm just happy it's gotten this far. So, so when people were telling me that I should feel horrible about it, I felt like, my God, am I a fraud for not feeling that horrible about it?
So, you're like, I already won. I got
in. Yeah, exactly.
Maybe it'd be gravy to go down to Austin.
And that's the thing. So it's like, it would have been a great trip, but the flip side, the plus side about all this is that it got into a ton of film festivals after South by, because once South by put its branding on it, it was like, so it got into a bunch of film festivals.
Again.
Yeah. So all summer it's been in film festivals. And so now we're about to launch on virtual cinema with Alamo Drafthouse. And then there's quite a few independent cinemas that are also going to be showing it. So we've been getting that ready to go. And then just on my own end, just trying to figure out what the next documentary is going to be. And I have a few different ideas, but it's, it's one of those things where it's like, some of them are video game related, some of them are pop culture and stuff, and just trying to figure out, just figure out what's next. Kind of want to expand my reach a bit.
Well, that's cool too. It's not like, well, been there, done that. Done, right? You want to continue to refine this and get better at your craft and try different stuff. So no, that's
exactly. Yeah, I just, my wife was like, what, you're gonna do another one,
And then learned so much. It'd be so much easier for round two.
That's exactly it. It's because I went to film school. I kind of got into video games by accident. And so, the way I looked at it was like, hey, this was basically grad school for me for filmmaking. And if I don't do something with all the crazy stuff I learned, like, then it, I know, I feel like it would be a waste. Exactly. And so there's just so many things that you can't learn in a classroom, you can't learn through YouTube videos and things like that. There's just sometimes you just got to make things and go through the pain of it to really get that deep learning. And that goes obviously with any type of medium. And so, I felt like I just gained a lot of knowledge, I should be capitalizing on. And there's, and I'm sure there's a whole new set of problems I'm going to run into, also.
But
for myself, I think it would be a shame not to, not to kind of take it to the next step.
You got the insert disc Electric Boogaloo Part 2 mid the year 2000.
Oh my God.
To 2009.
You or somebody from that, from that group needs to do something. Because I would love to know what the hell happened in 2000. Because I thought the 90s were crazy, but like, I know enough of you guys from the 2000s that I've heard stories, and it's kind of like really, like, what the hell happened after I left? Like, all hell broke loose.
Lord of the Flies, crazy.
Exactly. I talked with John Vignacchi and Adam Boyes and stuff, and they would tell me things. It's like,
so you see, this thing was, it was crazy. It was off the hook.
But I think one of them. And definitely, tell me if I'm wrong on this, but I think one of the weirder things that seemed to happen in 2000, from what I gathered, was a lot of upper management came in that had no business working in video games. Yep. You know, and I think in the 90s, I think in the 90s, it was different because it was most everybody had come from a video game background from the 80s. So they had, you know, some knowledge, or if they didn't have the knowledge, they stayed away. You know what I mean? Right. They didn't feel like they can tell Mark Chmiel or Ed Boon what they should be doing. It was just kind of like, tell us when the game is done and we'll like market it. That's it. You know? But yeah, at least in the 2000s, from what I had heard, it seemed like just like a bunch of, you know, carpetbaggers came in.
Yeah. There was just, you know, it's always been this weird, like, I was at Viacom New Media, right? So a big media company, and it was Icom Simulations, but then it became Viacom New Media, which division of Viacom, 1515 Broadway, MTV, Beavis, you know, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. But then there's this kind of thought that all media is the same. So video game, what's the difference from a TV show? And you can have somebody that does this thing for MTV or Nickelodeon, then do the same thing for video games, and maybe not, right? So there's kind of like this thought that those worlds are overlapping, and sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. So there were people, you know, luckily there were some steady folks there still, like, you know, Kenny and stuff like that, but at a higher level, you know, after Neil was gone and things like that, it was like, what is your background? So it was and then people get kind of hung up on slogans and catchphrases, and they were just kind of grabbing for straws. And at that time it was just like, we're just gonna dig the moat around Mortal Kombat and just do our thing and go from there. So there was some definite weird times back then, for sure. I'll leave it at that. So kind of pivoting, like, technology wise, like what are your thoughts around AR, VR, MR?
Yeah, you know, I'm sure anything I predict is going to be completely wrong about, because I think everybody's been wrong about AR and VR.
Virtual Boy is going to be huge.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, you know, believe it or not, I think the most used gaming device in my household is my Oculus Quest. And then probably the Switch is probably a very close second, you know, but like, you know, my kids love the Quest a lot, and I really enjoy a lot too. So I like that, you know, but gaming wise, I still have a hard time with VR in terms of like a mass market gaming thing. But, you know, for me, I think VR in particular with headsets, you know, is really, you know, for me, it's less about entertainment, and I think there's a whole other market for it. You know, obviously there's, you know, training simulations, there's educational markets. I think there's a lot of things. And I think to me, it's, I almost felt like it was a bit of a misstep to keep trying to push VR as gaming. I think it just gave it the wrong impression. And I just felt like, you know, if they kept it more as this high-tech solution for businesses or science research and things like that, that just happens to play games. If it went from that type of market to, and then trickle down to consumer, I think it would have been better than what they're trying to do now, which is trying to make it an, you know, an all-in-one entertainment for everybody. I just, you know, I think a lot of people just aren't super comfortable with VR. AR, I think AR, once it becomes something where it's a comfortable pair of glasses that are really light, that you can, you know, that then you can see the world with, I think that's going to be when it takes off. I hate the whole AR with, you know, using your phone or tablet. It's just not fun to do. I mean, technology wise I think it's great. I think there's some really great things that you can do with it, and obviously things like, you know, Pokemon Go, you know, really brought that to the masses and everything, but it's such a outlier compared to what's out there. And so, but I think, again, the technology I think is great. I just think that the idea of using our handheld device is a bad idea. But I think, you know, once you have a pair of glasses and it just becomes seamless with your world, you don't have to think about it, you don't have to hold something, I think that's when it's really going to take off. So, but I love, you know, in general, though, I love AR and VR. You know, the work I'm doing now is, I hesitate to call it MR, but, you know, like, we just call it like, hey, you know, it's VR without headsets. You know, I love big screen immersive experiences. And and there's a big push with that across the, you know, different areas. And so I've been playing in that space for, you know, for like the last couple of years now. And again, I'm probably going to be like, you know, 5 years from now, someone's going to listen to this and say, man, you were like so stupidly wrong.
You're way off.
Yeah, it's way off. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. But
yeah, like the Magic Leap, you know, as cool as the tech is, like at that price point, to aim it at the consumer and be like, yeah, exactly, give me $2,500 and walk around with this hockey puck strapped around your, you know, it's like, what? It's like,
yeah, for something like that. And even with like HoloLens, which is really impressive stuff. You know, the problem is, it's like, the, you know, they, on one end, they're saying that, hey, this is, you know, basically a $3,000 dev kit that's not made for the consumer. But then they're showing things that are very game related that make it seem like it is for the consumer. It's a very mixed messaging. I think that's where Magic Leap kind of fell into some trouble, because then when they came out with, oh, here, now you can buy it and it's $3,000, even though they call it dev kit, people look at that and say, like, I'm not gonna pay $3,000 for, you know, for something that I, you know, that has limited abilities. So the messaging is just, it seems like super, super mixed on that.
You know, in the enterprise space and other space, it's super valuable.
And there's some
cool stuff that LevelX and our, you know, our parent company Brainlab are doing together, you know, for neurosurgeons and doing pre-visualization before going in for, you know, surgeries, doing brain surgery and stuff that you can really do in that space in a unique way that is powerful and useful versus just, you know, porting something for the consumer side to that device and then thinking people are going to spend the money for that. So
I think Microsoft was really smart with HoloLens too, in concentrating on enterprise, you know, because when the first HoloLens came out, it was just like, they were showing just like really cute, whimsical things and stuff like that. And, you know, and it's all, you know, everything's a learning lesson. So, but it's, I think it just, people looked at that and I think they were expecting something way more than what it was technically possible in doing. But I noticed with HoloLens too, they kind of figured out who their audience really was, and it's a much smarter move.
Cool. So like, where can people find you online? Like your website, Twitter, InsertCoin website, stuff like that?
For the film itself, it's InsertCoinDoc.com. So InsertCoinDoc.com. That's where it's getting updated with the latest info in terms of like where it's screening, how to get access to it, you know, film festivals and things like that.
So is that in theaters or video on demand or
comedy? Yeah, it's both. So the first launch is with, you know, they're calling them virtual cinemas. So Alamo Drafthouse obviously they have theaters all over the country. But they're also doing virtual cinemas. So you can buy your tickets through Alamo Drafthouse site and gain access to see the film, you know, from anywhere, you know, at home and such. There are a few theaters around the country that are also going to be showing, theaters that are open. And so so all that information is on the website. And then on Twitter, it's InsertCoinDoc, or I should say at InsertCoinDoc. And then and then that's the same for Instagram, InsertCoinDoc. And then for myself is Josh Y T S U I on Twitter. And I'm fairly active on Twitter, but I talk mostly about food and complaining about living in the suburbs. Your mileage may vary on your enjoyment on that account.
We follow each other on Twitter every once in a while. I'm like, I sat there and ate a whole box of Cheez-Its watching CNN with the politics and trying not to lose my mind. So
I try not to drunk tweet, you know.
Did I say that shit? Delete,
yeah,
delete,
exactly. Delete. Exactly. Yeah. Those are the best ways. Yeah. And I don't really do Facebook a whole lot and such, but there is a InsertCoin documentary page on Facebook also.
Just to people out there, because this will be coming out hopefully right around when the movie's released, and obviously people will be listening to this after it's been out, should check it out. Like I really enjoyed it. I learned some stuff that I didn't know, and having been at Midway, and you know, it's a great story, and it's just to understand the power of gaming and what kind of position Midway was in, and like how arcades, you know, were right at the heyday and then they crashed and how they came back, and the people behind them and the stories. If you're into video games at all, you should totally check it out.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, no, it was a crazy times.
Yeah, it, you know, hats off to you for putting what, you know, 5 years of your life into this, and as you shared, it was not an easy endeavor, and it's cool that it's there, right? Like it's time stamped. There's that thing now, so that people can enjoy it now and 20 years from now, and the stories need to be told. So it's cool that you did that.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you, Josh. Have a good night.
Thanks. You too. Great talking to you as always.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast.
go to the website at gamedevadvice.com, and you can find the show notes along with show notes for all the other episodes. Please also check out the new Patreon page at patreon.com/gamedevadvice. Have a lot of options up there for how you can support the show. Again, that's patreon.com/gamedevadvice. Thanks again for listening and being part of the show. Take care. Bye-bye.